tonight on Arena. Nicola Barker on her new novel, Tony Interrupter. Kian Sweeney plays live in studio, and the best and worst of on-screen chemistry. You can contact us on 51551, of course, email arena at rte.ie, and you can find us on Instagram these days as well, at rte_arena. Tonight, we start with Irish producer and pianist Kian Sweeney. He's stepping out from behind the studio desk with As If I Always Knew. It's a new solo project that returns him to his first instrument, the piano. Best known as the force behind A Thousand Beasts, whose collaborations have earned over 130 million streams, his career has ranged from touring worldwide with the RTE Concert Orchestra and Moya Brennan to producing chart-ready tracks for a brand new wave of Irish artists. With As If I Always Knew, he strips everything back to raw improvised piano pieces. They are captured live in a single take for his debut album, Improvisations 1, which is out on September 10th. Following the singles Sleep and Danny Boy, he's already brought the project to the stage with a sold-out Cork Midsummer Festival show, and Dublin Fringe and Culture Night dates are ahead. And Kian Sweeney joins me in studio now. Kian, we've just talked about the new project. It's called As If I Always Knew. Why this project? Why now? Why step away from the production that you've been doing and do something that's obviously very different?
That's a very good question. It's not that I'm stepping away from the production. I think I started off as a pianist when I came out of college. That's what I did. And I spent a lot of time touring the world, thankfully, with some very, very great artists, Irish artists. And then I stepped into the studio. My aim was always to be a producer, but the pandemic happened and I spent many, many years locked up in the studio on my own. I still do that. That's like the day job. I do it all the time. But we, myself and my wife, Laura, we bought a house about a year ago, and the first thing we did was buy a piano. And when we bought the piano, very quickly, I started doing my thing on the piano, just playing around. And every now and again, Laura would be like, "What's that?" And I was like, "I don't know. I just made it up." And she'd be like, "That's great. That's, why don't you do something with that?" And then I got the idea, I probably should do something with that. So the concept behind the name, As If I Always Knew, is this is basically exactly the music I did when I was 15 or 16. Before I thought, oh, this is what I should be doing, or this is what I'm meant to be doing. It was kind of what came out of me at 2 o'clock in the morning when I should have went to sleep or something like that. So that's where the name came from.
Have you always been a musician? Did you come from a musical family?
Yeah. My mum played piano. It's always been a musical family. We had a piano in the house, guitar in the house. So as long as I can remember, she would have, I didn't really want to go to piano lessons at the start, but she made me stick with them anyway for a few years. And then I caught the bug by the time I was 8 or 9.
And thanks for that, Mammy.
I'm sure she's listening now too.
tell me about then putting all of these pieces together in the way that they have. I want to ask you about specific ones that are going to be on the album, because if people want to listen to them, they're out there in the streaming world already. The number 4 is based entirely on the black keys of the piano.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, the black keys are a very open sound. Can I play this? Will you be able to hear this?
I think so.
That's just the black keys. It's a very open sound. It's a pentatonic sound. I don't know if people have seen, like, Bobby McFerrin will do things like this where it's probably one of the most folk scales out there. And it's completely open. It's something I wanted to experiment with. I was actually studying, I was going back and teaching myself some Debussy. He's got a piece from Estampe Pagode, which is based entirely on Oriental music. And that was the piece that inspired me behind that. So then I kind of challenged myself to say, all right, can I improvise something just using black keys? And that ended up being, the reason it's called the number 4, it was the 4th take we did when we recorded the album. And that became the first single from the piece, yeah.
Okay, well, you are going to play something for us live a little bit later on, but yeah. I want to take this. This is the version that's going to appear on the album. This is the number 4.
Thank you.
Thank you.
lest people think that you have decided to take a piece, call it something, and then simply rip off Danny Boy. That's not that at all. That is. Let's do this the other way around then. That is your version of Danny Boy from the album. So let me talk to you about that first then. I mean, it's one of the most well-known melodies anywhere, both amongst Irish people and Irish people around the world. So why have a go at that?
I think Irish people kind of get the ick from that piece of music, to be honest. I was very lucky. I worked with a group called the Celtic Tenors a lot. I was their musical director. They gave me, I'm very grateful to what they gave me. They gave me a huge chance to tour across many, many countries. And that song, they used to finish with that a cappella. And that piece is very, very powerful, particularly for the Irish-American community. And I remember the first time we went on tour, they were doing it, and it was almost kind of like I looked at the set list and kind of let out a little bit of a groan, going, oh God, they're doing Danny Boy. And then after 2 or 3 years of just hearing it and seeing the reaction and the way people over there can connect with it, and I think stripping it right back, it's just an incredibly powerful piece of music. It obviously has resonated with people so much. And I thought, let's just go for this block harmony thing. Let's see if we can interpret it in my own way, in its own voicing, and see if we can kind of break free from the shackles and the baggage that comes with the tune.
Okay, I think we have the number four now. I'm getting thumbs up from this. So maybe just tee this up for us, because this is the version of the number four that's going to be on the album.
Yeah, so the number four is the one with all the black notes, and that is the one that is an open pentatonic sound. So again, it sounds a little bit like it could be something oriental, but a lot of Child's Lullabies are also in pentatonic scales. Okay. So a nice open sound.
Let's take a little from that. Four, and it is by Cian Sweeney from his brand new project. He's here in front of me. We've just introduced As If I Always Knew, which is the name of the project, but the album itself, so recorded in a single afternoon, as I understand, no post-production of any kind done on it. It's a bit of a high wire act. That's not the easiest thing in the world to do. Why embrace that and you know, the imperfections that you might end up with?
I think I've probably been striving so much for perfection for so many years now. I think that's what you do when you try to master a craft. And I think this is a thing across society, probably with the internet and social media and so many things as well, that I feel like there's almost like people are yearning for the imperfection a little bit. It is scary, but I think it just naturally came about. And I see, even since I started this project about over a year ago, like the whole thing was, we had the piano in the house. I knew a brilliant videographer. I was like, come over, we'll set up two microphones and just see what happens. And we did 15 improvisations and we maybe turned 8 of those into the album. And I just feel like people probably resonate and connect with it a little bit more. So in a sense, it's about trying to be a little bit more present and a little bit less algorithmically curated, probably.
Which is, you know, something that's happening quite a lot and something that needs to be applauded. I've seen you citing influences, everybody from like Nils Fram to Mihalo Suluwan. You've mentioned Debussy already. Where do you see what you do as sitting in that? And that's a very wide landscape, very wide.
I think it's somewhere else. I do feel like it's my own voice. I've kind of taken these influences from everywhere else and I just have an approach to the piano. It's funny, again, to go back to it, particularly when I was working for other people, I was very concerned about making I fit into whatever they were doing stylistically. So in a way, I kind of subdued my natural style. And that's a big part of this project, is actually going back to the voice. Like, what is the first instinct that happens to me? Removing the kind of the thinking barrier and just going straight from impulse to piano. That's exactly what I try and do when I'm performing. I'll have little themes, I'll have little ideas, I might know where I'm going, but I'll always leave space. Similar to how you might have a conversation. I think that's the best way to describe it.
It sounds a little bit like jazz.
A little bit, yeah, yeah. There is a bit to that. I mean, jazz has got its structure in terms of like everybody kind of knows what the chords are and they're following a lead sheet, and that mine might be a little bit different because sometimes I'll go off a feeling rather than a... But yeah, there definitely is a parallel to that, all right, yeah.
You're going to play something for us live now in studio now that we've listened to some stuff from the album. What are you going to do?
I'm going to improvise from a piece called... Well, the theme is called Good Morning, so I'll actually show you. This is the theme, very simply. I'm just going to improvise around that for a couple of minutes.
Okay. That'll do nicely.
There you go.
That's Cian Sweeney live on Arena from the As If I Always Knew project. The live performance thing is obviously clearly very important to this. You've got shows at the Dublin Fringe and Culture Night coming up, the show at St Finbar's Cathedral as well. I've seen the clips on your Instagram and I urge people to go and have a look at the As If I Always Knew Instagram, or they'll find it currently. It's up on the RT Arena Instagram stories. Tell me about the live performance part of this. It is quite special.
Yeah, the whole concept behind it was for live performance. I had a mad idea that we would perform with a grand piano and an audience lying on yoga mats in circles. So I approached the team at the Cork Midsummer Festival and they were sufficiently crazy enough to let me do it. And so we did it in St Finbar's Cathedral underneath a huge installation of the sun called Helios by Luke Sharam. And it was incredible. It was. I was very lucky. We sold it out. It was beautiful. It was magical. We filmed the whole thing as well, so we will release the entire concert once the album's been out. And now I have been lucky enough to have had the opportunity to bring it to the Dublin Fringe Festival. So we're doing four nights there: the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 20th. And I'm also going to be performing it at Cork City Hall for Culture Night. So people are more than welcome to bring their yoga mats, come along to Cork City Hall. We're doing a show at 5:30 and 8:00, I think. So come in. relax. There'll be seats there for people that don't want to do yoga mats, obviously. But yeah, that's the idea.
If you want to be old-fashioned and sit down, you can do that as well.
Absolutely, yeah. I won't force any. They can stand if they want. Brilliant. I don't mind. Yeah, yeah.
Keen Sweeney, it's been brilliant to talk to you tonight. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for your time. Thank you so much.
Improvisations 1 by Keen Sweeney's project, As If I Always Knew, is released on the 10th of September. And Keen will be performing a string of gigs, as he's just said, at the Dublin Fringe from September 16th to 20th and a Culture Night performance at Cork City Hall on September 19th. More info and tickets available from fringefest.com and culturenight.ie. You're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. Now, unless you're a stranger to the internet or have been on a remote island for the last month or so, you will have seen the hundreds of Are They Really Going Out With Each Other articles about the stars of The Naked Gun, Liam Neeson and Pamela Anderson. The two of them met on set and now seemingly can't keep their hands off each other. What about other on-screen love interests that sizzle with chemistry, and maybe more interestingly, a few that were obviously the exact opposite? Joining me now are film critics Paul Whittington and Serena Bellissimo with their examples of the best and worst in on-screen chemistry. Serena, let's do Liam and Pamela first because they're at the very beginning. Is it real chemistry? Are they putting it on? Is it just great PR for the film? What's your take on this?
It's all of the above. I would like to think that it's real, but I think we've seen this happen before as well. I think if it was real, it probably would have been more low-key, but this is perfect for the film. I mean, we want to see both of them happy, so we're so invested. We want them to be in love. And I think because on screen, when you watch them on screen, there is undeniable chemistry there.
Oh, yeah, they're great. And I think that comes from the fact that they both had a perfectly clear understanding of the kind of thing they were involved with, and they went for it. But they're really good together, and her comic timing is great, and so is his, which, you know, shouldn't be surprising, but is. But they're actors. And
Are you being cynical now?
No, I'm not being cynical. It's just very hard.
Maybe just
because
a realist.
They do for decades, you know, they do chemistry kind of tests and all this kind of nonsense. But they can't do that. It either works or it doesn't. And sometimes people are merely competent. Sometimes something special happens. And I don't think anybody really knows why.
I think for those people who have yet to see it, let's take a little clip.
What if we had a little dinner together? I sure could go for a bite.
Slow down, chef. This turkey burns at 450.
How hot was I cooking?
About 1,000. Turkey needs slow and low.
Unless you like your center pink.
No, I love my centers pink.
You're not worried the rare meat will ruin a good stuffing?
As long as you don't mind if I get salmonella.
Mind it. I prefer it. I like a sick little boy.
Okay, let's go to the very opposite end of the scale, possibly, Paul.
Yeah.
We're going to scroll back all the way to Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. They had it very much so. I mean, but when they began, when they met each other, where were Bogie and Bacall in their careers?
He had spent a sort of good decade as second fiddle to people like George Raft and James Cagney in Warner Brothers' Pop Boys, great gangster films, and he finally made his own breakthrough. But he was a tough guy. He was playing detectives. He was playing, and that's what he did. And he was still doing it when he and Lauren Bacall came together. But they only made three films together. But she changed his life. He changed his. Everybody knows that. Obviously, it would be slightly icky these days because she was 19 and he was a sprightly 44, but she was a very old head on young shoulders. 19, she had been modelling since she was 15 and given out to her mother and had come to Hollywood to make it in pictures. She was well able for him, and they just liked each other, and they were electric on screen together. I mean, the best film they made together was not the first one they made, Have and Have Not. It was The Big Sleep, which I think you may have a clip of. And for anybody who hasn't seen it, it's a marvelous film, and they just sort of sparks fly between them.
You could take almost anything, I think, from any of the scenes that they share in it. Let's just take a little taste of it.
Tell me, what do you usually do when you're not working?
Play the horses, fool around.
No women?
Well, I'm generally working on something most of the time.
Could that be stretched to include me?
Well, I like you. I told you that before.
I liked hearing you say it. But you didn't do much about it.
Well, neither did you.
Well, speaking of horses, I like to play them myself. But I like to see them work out a little first. See if they're front runners or come from behind. Find out what their whole card is. What makes them run.
Find out mine?
I think so.
Go ahead.
I'd say you don't like to be rated. You like to get out in front. Open up a lead, take a little breather in the back stretch, and then come home free.
You don't like to be rated yourself.
I haven't met anyone yet that could do it. Any suggestions?
That is Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall in The Big Sleep. Oh, that's just extraordinary. Serena, yeah. Let's do James Cameron's Titanic.
Can we?
Jack and Rose, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. Start with their on-screen chemistry. What did you make of it when that film finally hit the big screens and all its big rumbly glory in 1997?
They were incredible on screen. I mean, down from literally steam coming off the screen when they were in that car and the window was fogging up. But the fun that they had, it was just the two of them were so perfectly matched. I know Leo had done a few films before that, but his star really was just on the rise. And I think, you know, the fact that they both came in at similar ages and they've navigated Hollywood and gone through the same similar career paths at the same time and been there for each other. I think because they were so powerful on screen, this is what happens with the on-screen chemistry as well. Because they're so powerful on screen, you actually want it to be true off screen. And they just look like the best of mates.
They got on and they definitely did. And they have remained in touch with each other, I think, yeah. So
the
whole
way through.
It does seem to help.
Is there an element of, and look, there is for me, that post-Revolutionary Road, which they both starred in, in an incredibly different story with very different characters, that has a kind of shadow now of their performances in Titanic, that you can't think of one without thinking of the other?
No. Does it?
Okay, that's just me then.
Is that the way you feel after you've seen them in Revolutionary Road?
I think post-Revolutionary Road, all I can think about anytime I see them is just the devastation of what happens to the two characters in that film.
And see, I think I really enjoyed that. Enjoyed is a really weird word to say when you're talking about that film, but I enjoyed seeing them play something different.
It was a very good film, that. It was unlucky not to do better than it did. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But I also love that they've teased us as well, going, who knows, you know, maybe in 20 years' time we get to tell another love story of a different sort when we're 70. And you know what? I'm in it for that. And I love, you know, not only do we get excited seeing them in Revolutionary Road or as Jack and Rose in the Titanic, but you see them on a red carpet, you see them get excited. Like, you know, after COVID, they hadn't seen each other for 3 years and I think it was at the Golden Globes and they ran to each other and they embraced each other.
I think you're right. Well, you can see in the film itself in Titanic that you can't fake enjoying yourself.
No.
And
they probably trauma bonded a bit as well. You know, 7 months of filming, Kate Winslet was under that water with no wetsuit on whatsoever. So it wasn't easy. And they were both, as I said, they were both at the same sort of stage in their career.
Okay, let's do Burton and Taylor for a number of reasons, because some extraordinary films came out of it, because their relationship is one that's talked about so much. There was a great book out about the nature of their relationship last year as well. Paul, talked to me about
Elizabeth and a very good documentary about her the last year, the week before. They were the original, tabloid frenzy creators, the two of them, because she was starring in Cleopatra. She got sick during, she was in hospital for about a year or something. Everything about that production was disastrous, and it was the most expensive film ever made, and it did do well actually in the end. But he had been cast as Mark Antony, and he was from a theatre background and very classical, very stern, and he thought she was a Hollywood starlet who didn't know how to act, and he was very impressed, and he revised his opinion quite quickly when he said after when he watched takes of her, he realised that she was doing all the stuff that he hadn't understood. They hit it off. Their respective marriages exploded, and they were going out careering around Rome, being followed by the paparazzi, which was a relatively new thing. So they'd go through all that. They got married. They got divorced. They got married again. He was her fifth and sixth husband, which I always like to say, but they were very good together. She could act, but she didn't always, but she really upped her game. And obviously the best thing they did together was it was Fred of Virginia Woolf, which is amazing from both of them in terms of the acting.
Okay, Serena, you liked Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper in the 2018 version of A Star Is Born.
They were incredible. I didn't expect to fall in love with the two of them on screen as much as I did. Again, it was just, you can't, like, you either have it sometimes or you don't. And the two of them, as soon as they were on screen together, that passion was flying off the screen. I mean, the one scene that I always tell people about, and they think I'm mad when I tell them this, but the one scene that, like, cemented their love for me was they're riding, he's riding on his motorbike and she's on the back and she's wearing these red boots. And all you see all of a sudden is the camera pans to his hand as he places his hand on her red boot. And it was just like, I get shivers even thinking about that. It was just like, it was down to touch.
Triggering for you.
Yeah. But again, it was like, you know, how we're talking about Pamela and Liam. Mm. That whole conversation started again. Are they, aren't they? And they were both
in
relationships.
And then they did the Oscar thing on the piano and everything. With just, I think they were playing it with it then. Though,
yeah,
the
but
stage, weren't they?
That felt so, like the girlfriend was sitting in the front row and they
felt a bit off, did it?
Yeah, because they did that whole Shallow performance. And
yeah.
I'm getting shivers just thinking about it. They were just incredible. Together.
I'm going to take a little from A Star Is Born, and this is Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper.
Why did you come back here?
Your friend brought me back here. I'm glad he did. Can I buy you a drink?
Oh, I got to change, and I've got paint in my hair. And
oh, it's not your real hair?
No, my hair is like your color, but
okay.
I paint it with this
makeup. Oh, I'd love to see what that looks like. I'll wait for you.
You want to wait, I'll come have a drink with you. Sure.
Okay, an open question for both of you. Were we really all so much very in love with Paul Mescal and Daisy Edgar-Jones in Normal People, or was that just a lockdown thing, Serena?
I haven't watched it since lockdown, so boredom, I think it was a lockdown thing. But the two of them together, the way they encapsulated young love was incredible. And like everyone else we're talking about, it sort of bubbled over into their social life, their personal lives.
Yeah.
And they're like, I look at them like I look at Kate and Leo. I think the two of them will continue to have this friendship together because they went through something so intense that nobody else understands what they went through at that time. They went from unknowns to everybody knowing their name and going crazy for them.
Yeah, I don't. You would wonder how the thing, if you watch it again now, how it would date, because I think it was very fortunate to appear at a time when nobody was able to do anything.
Yeah.
But and I think it was quite slight as well. Personally, the TV series, whatever about the book, but I think they were excellent, and that's when everybody started to realize what Paul Mescal was all about.
Okay, we have a lot more to talk about. We haven't even gotten as far as where on screen chemistry is badly misplaced, and we're going to do some of those in a few minutes. I've got Paul Whittington and Serena Bellissimo with me, still talking about the best and worst on-screen moments of chemistry in the history of film. Serena, it's about time we talked about some same-sex couples on screen. You liked Timothy Chalamet and Armie Hammer in Call Me By Your Name.
Oh, I thought the two of them together were incredible. It was set in Italy. It was set in summer. Everything about it was hot, but the relationship between the two of them, I never know how to say his name.
Timothy.
It's just Timothy. Okay, so Timothy Chalamet was a 17-year-old student. His dad had employed this assistant who was older. It was basically a coming-of-age film, and it was so
fantastic,
hot,
film.
Wasn't it?
Yeah,
it
was, and then suddenly afterwards you weren't allowed to like it anymore.
I know, and I did. Do you know what? I did have a problem putting this in here, and I went, no.
No, but you're right. It was really good. They were both really good. Yeah,
yeah, and like, I love, if you haven't seen it and you're missing your summer.
There's a famous scene with an item of fruit as well, and it's they're having fun with it all, and they were really good. Yeah.
And that's the thing as well. I think these things work when you can tell that the two leads are actually enjoying what they're doing. There is, now look, sometimes the hatred leads to the passion on
that
screen.
Can work. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But in this case, I think you
have to. And in life.
Exactly. But I think it had to be very tender, and this was tender.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Paul, Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain, story of two gay cowboys.
Yeah.
Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal much further back in their careers.
Yeah, and I think that this film very famously. It didn't win Oscars because of Crash, which is often regarded as the worst film ever to win. And it might be, although it's up against some opposition. But I think it's forgotten that it would have been a courageous thing for both of them to do, because queer cinema, gay cinema was not in the mainstream then at all. And if it was, it was all very sort of token, etc. But this was based on an Annie Proulx novel about two cowboys in Wyoming in 1963 who fall in love on the trail. And the two of them, Ang Lee said afterwards that he couldn't believe how sort of unbothered they were by the fact they were going to have to do, everybody remembers the ruckus and the tent and so forth, and that they were totally unfazed by that, and that they just were able, they knew each other, so they were able for it. I mean, everybody knows how good Heath Ledger was and Gyllenhaal too at that time, but they had something very difficult to do, because this happens and neither of them are equipped emotionally to deal with it or know what to do about it afterwards. There's no context for it in the America of that time, and they were super in it.
And I like the idea of it as well. You haven't quite paired it with it, but it's an interesting counterpoint, the idea of two cowboys who have incredible platonic chemistry in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And perhaps, you know, one could read unspoken things into Butch Cassidy, which was made in 1969. But this was a case of often with the casting of films, it's who can't do it and who can do it. And Steve McQueen was supposed to do it with Paul Newman, which would have changed the dynamic entirely. Mm. Robert Redford was a TV actor, like people like Gene Hackman at the time, who'd come through television and hadn't done much film. And they cast him. I'm sure they tested them together, but they can't have known what was going to happen. In the sense, and they became great friends, obviously, but in the sense where they had this kind of humorous understanding and finishing sort of sentences almost, and really making us believe in the friendship between these two people, which was very different in real life, I have to say. Mm. Sundance Kid was rather more unpalatable and brutal than Robert Redford was. But they only did one more film together with George Roy Hill again, who had directed that one, The Sting, and they very wisely never did anything together again after that.
I controversially think The Sting might be a better film.
I don't think it's that controversial. I think it's an irresistible film. It just has this charm about it, and the way it's made in studio sense makes it seem, it might look a bit hokey now, but it's a lovely film, I think, that film.
Okay, we're going to move much, much, much closer to the modern day. It's one that kind of turned up on both of your lists, but Serena, I want you to talk about it. Celine Song's Past Lives, Greta Lee and T.O.U. in this film. I could ask you what you loved about it, but it was something that audiences everywhere loved about it.
It was just so sublime, I thought. Everything about this was... I was trying to think of the Korean word they used again. What was the word... Do you remember that?
Don't be looking at me. I don't know what it was.
There was a word in there to describe what their relationship was.
Yeah.
And it'll come to me at the most inopportune time. But the Greta Lee and Teo Yo were just the way they played it. This could have been so melodramatic and so over the top, but
it's really under, yeah.
It was. Yeah. It was just, I didn't feel like I was watching a couple acting. I felt like it was just a documentary.
Well, the themes it teased out as well. It was based on her life, and basically, she no longer feels quite Korean, and she thinks he's terribly Korean when they meet as grown-ups, because she left when she was 12, and so she's displaced and he's displaced, and is their affection for each other merely based upon the fact that they were best friends and then she left? And all that gets really nicely teased out by them, and it's a wonderful film if people haven't seen it.
It's stunning.
I could not be more thrilled that you chose to include Richard Linklater's trilogy with Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy.
Yeah.
The Before Sunset, Before Sunrise. Before Sunrise is the 1995 one where they meet initially. The one that I have an enormous growth for is Before Sunset, the one that occurs in the middle.
Before Midnight. I thought that was great because it was the messiest of them. The thing that they managed to do, so they had a lot to do, obviously, and Julie Delpy has said since that who wrote it? We wrote it. Ethan Hawke hasn't really said very much about it, but they had to, you can see they had to improvise all the time. They knew each other a bit, but not very well. It was filmed on location. It felt like Linklater knew what he was doing. It felt like it was sort of made up and messy. And it's very amusing because they're toying with the idea that what would it be like if am I the person for you? Are you the person for me? It's all very playful. But then we watch them choose each other and the sort of consequences of that. They're brilliant together. I think they're the most convincingly real and messy screen couple I can think of, actually.
Okay, we've done enough of the good. We're going to have to at least skirt over the absolutely appalling.
There's a few.
Serena, do you want to start with Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan in all of the 50 Shades films?
Yeah. Now, look, I never read any of the
Poor old Jamie Dornan, and he's a good actor as well.
And so is Dakota Johnson.
Yes.
And yeah. I just feel like when they don't have it, they just didn't have it. And I don't know if it came down to them. I don't know if it came down to the direction.
Script,
I know by the
sometimes, isn't it?
The script was appalling. And I know by the time, and I only watched these for work.
I only saw the first one. I somehow contrived to miss them.
I never watched any of them because they're just terrible. And by the third, you knew that they had signed, people who had signed this before their careers had skyrocketed in a different direction, they're like, oh, we have to go back and make this. Yeah. And by the third, I felt like I could see the two of them going, we don't want to be here.
Yeah, they didn't work for some reason. But you never know if it's them or the script, because I think if the script is terrible, it can look like...
The script was atrocious.
Yeah.
And I think they knew that too.
Maybe the scripts got better in the second and third ones. I only saw the first
one. I didn't see the other ones either. Paul, you've picked one of the all-time greats. Natalie Portman and Hayden Christensen.
Yeah.
Star Wars again, Attack of the Clones.
And poor old Hayden Christensen. It was a bad film. It ought to be remembered. And actually, I remember if you go back to Star Wars, A New Hope, the first one, Harrison Ford famously said to George Lucas, George, you can type this shit, but you sure can't say it. And so there had always been a problem with dialogue. Excuse me. There had always been a problem with dialogue in these films, and it was at its worst in this. But there was something between the two of them that just wasn't happening. There was something dead there. And they were terrible.
Because they're obviously two actors. I mean, Hayden Christensen has been in some really interesting things. Natalie Portman's an extraordinary actor.
Yeah, he was tainted much more by association than her.
It almost sunk him from day one.
Yeah, it did. He just, he's playing in a sense a very iconic role, and he's in it. I don't mean him personally. He's kind of a drip in it, and she looked very unhappy as well. And she shot out of the traps as soon as she got rid of that role. Yeah.
Okay, Serena, Justin Baldoni and Blake Lively in It Ends With Us.
Yeah.
Because some screen pairings end up in the courts. For those people who haven't read all of the column inches devoted to this over the last year and a half or more, have you got a 25 words or less on what happened?
How much can we say about this? Basically, they were, Blake had just come off her maternity leave. Colleen Hoover's book was a bestseller. They decided to make this. Justin actually directed it as well. The press tour happened, and we all started noticing that everybody was involved in the press tour except Justin Baldoni. He was turning up to red carpets on his own. Then I'm so in fear of litigation. So what we will say is that they're basically coming out and suing each other. They're both saying that they had both been mistreated by the other party. Mm. This
it's
is getting
very difficult to understand.
Yeah, it's getting ugly, like really ugly.
I realise that the visual is half of this, but let's play a clip from the film so people can have a little listen.
I appreciate you walking me, but
I can't stop thinking about you.
I'm right here.
That's the problem.
I thought we agreed to be friends.
You did. That was like hours ago. Can I just kiss you?
Oh my
just once.
God, you are
just
pushy.
Once. That's all I need to get you out of my system.
Oh, that's it. That'll do it? Okay, well, good luck with that.
Is that a yes?
Just once?
Just once.
Okay.
Let's move on swiftly and let's finish with one of the good ones. Let's finish with one of the good ones. Possibly my favourite romantic comedy of all time, When Harry Met Sally. So Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan. Serena?
On paper, the two of them don't work. Mm-hmm. You're seeing, like, Meg Ryan at the time as well was at the height of, like, she was the it girl, the rom-com
girl.
Forget
how good she was, though.
She was incredible. Really, like, in the 90s, she was your go-to. And I don't understand how her career plummeted after that. But her and Billy Crystal together, I think, are a lot of our favourite couples. And I have to say, were you one of them who was very excited last year when there was all this thing around them going, all this hype going, they're reuniting.
Yeah, they were photographed together, weren't they?
And then it was for a Super Bowl commercial.
Oh, I thought that would have been the worst idea imaginable. I don't want that story revisited. I want it left exactly where it is.
Were you happy with the Super Bowl commercial, though, seeing them together again in their cable knit jumpers?
I was.
But she was such a skillful comedian. Yeah. I mean, she did it again and again, and she was very good at playing opposite people. And he wasn't always the world's greatest actor, but he was terrific in that film.
And obviously all of the credit needs to go to Nora Ephron for actually writing When Harry Met Sally and creating those two extraordinary characters. Yeah. It has been a joy, Paul Whittington, Serena Bellissimo. Thank you for spilling the beans on the real story behind this. Wait, I can see Serena's vibrating because something has happened that you want to mention.
In the world.
Yeah, we're not ending without telling you what's happening in the real world. Your English teacher and your gym teacher are getting married. That is what Taylor Swift and Travis Kelce have just posted on Instagram. Before we came in, it had only been up for 30 minutes and there were already 3 million likes.
Gosh.
There you go.
And you have been to the point of distraction for the last
30 minutes. I was wondering when we'd get to talk about this love story.
Thanks for coming in and thanks for talking to us. Nicola Barker is an English novelist known for her experimental and often darkly comic narratives. With a career spanning over 3 decades, she's published 13 novels and 2 short story collections, earning prestigious accolades such as the International Dublin Literary Award, Booker Prize shortlistings, and the Goldsmiths Prize for Happy. Her latest novel, Tony Interrupter, is a vibrant and anarchic comedy set in a fictionalised Canterbury, and through a cast of characters weaves a satirical exploration, I'll get there eventually, of art, authenticity and the digital age. Nicola Barker, thank you so much for joining us on Arena tonight.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And maybe start by telling us a little about where the story of Tony Interrupter starts.
It starts at a live music performance of experimental jazz. And this character called John Lincoln Braithwaite stands up and just asks if the performance is honest. And that kind of generates, it's filmed by someone in the audience, and it generates a huge amount of disquiet in a selection of characters in the novel.
Okay. It's obviously an awful lot more than that. That ripple then goes out further into the world through a kind of quite a diverse ensemble of characters. Tell me about how it affects them and where that goes.
It does. I think fundamentally it's a book about, I suppose, the tension between what it is to be authentic and what it is to be accountable, which at some level is the tension we're all involved in culturally. So at one end you've got people trying to be honest, trying to be their authentic selves, trying to be true to themselves. At the other end, you've got people who are really wanting us all to be accountable, to be very careful about the things we think and say. I suppose at some level you could say that's a kind of right and a left way of looking at the world. So the book is really kind of an exploration of the rest of us in the middle and how we make sense of those two, that tension, how we can be honest and how the characters are fighting through this, how they can be honest, but how they can also be accountable and responsible for the things they think, say, and do.
And it's a little bit the intersection of the digital age with the world of live performance in there as well. I mean, obviously from the very beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't really, as a modern novelist, you can't really write about anything else. It's kind of a nightmare, isn't it? That sort of is the only subject there is. I mean, it's also a book fundamentally about interruption and how we live such interrupted lives. So the book is essentially a lot of interrupted conversations, people arguing with each other. And I'm kind of playing with the idea that interruption is something that's kind of devastating to us as people and as a culture, because we have no attention span and because it's so hard to focus. But at another level, interruption is something so rich because consensus needs to be interrupted sometimes, and we need to, and that's the only way that we can start to think differently. So I suppose the book is dealing with a lot of paradoxes to do with human nature and to do with how we interact with each other.
I've seen you say on a number of occasions that you write for the moment. Why so?
I don't know. I suppose that I try to make my books topical. I'm interested in reading culture and exploring ideas within it. It's quite hard to do that as a novelist because there's such a delay between finishing a book and the publishing of it. So this book was finished probably a year and a half ago. And a lot of the issues in my mind anyway have become more complex and more interesting since it was written. But I try to write, yes, about what's happening now.
Was there an inspiration for Tony Interrupter to begin with, a single actor or a series of acts, or is that not necessarily the way the writing of the book works?
Well, no, I suppose I am someone that has watched a certain amount of experimental jazz in my life. And as an experimenter myself, I'm always fascinated by how, even when you're experimenting, there's the possibility that you can play into a certain amount of cliche and predictability. Just because you're experimenting, it doesn't mean that what you're doing is necessarily fresh. So I'm kind of poking fun at that, but also I do think the book is a real defense of what it is, what it takes to experiment, how hard it is not to be loved by most people in what you do.
Does that mean you're poking fun at yourself a little bit, given the nature of the experimental nature of your books over the years?
Absolutely. How could I not? Yes. I know. I mean, there's always the idea that because you're writing fiction that you should want to appeal to the broadest possible audience, but I can't do that. That's not the nature of the work I do. And I'm very aware of that. And I'm aware of how, people see my work, which my work isn't difficult, but I do deal with difficult ideas maybe. So I'm very aware of that. And yes, I like to create mischief within that arena.
Yeah, I think the phrase you used at one stage was that you were a niche writer and that you saw no harm in it. I mean, I would have thought that that's where a lot of the best writing comes from.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. It would be lovely for me if I could write an incredibly commercial novel. I'm not going to pretend that that wouldn't be a lovely thing for me, but it just isn't who I am or what I do, because my desire to disrupt narrative is too strong. And so it always trips me up in the writing of anything, unfortunately. Yes.
Going back to Tony Interrupter, it's set in a fictionalized Canterbury. Why did you choose there?
I have never mentioned Canterbury, but yes, it is essentially, it's just a place I know fairly well. I live in Kent, and it is the locus of a lot of kind of experiment and radicalism, and, you know, it's a typical kind of university town. So, yeah.
I'm interested to ask you about, you won what was then the Dublin International Literary Award. It's 25 years ago this year. It was in 2000. I've talked to a few winners over the years. It's one of those awards that can be life-changing because of the prize fund. I think it would have been 100,000 old punts in 2000. Was it life-changing for you at the time?
Oh, absolutely amazing for me, yes. For someone that was writing books and getting probably £1,000-£1,500 for a book, to get that huge sum of money was really remarkable. And obviously I paid off a huge lump of my mortgage. I was able to stop working for a period of time. You know, I had a job at that time. So yes, it was amazing. And what a crazy prize. Yeah, what a wonderful prize.
You write longer novels and shorter ones. It's been a while since your last longer one, which I think was the Yips. But you've been talking about writing the next long novel almost since then, because as I understand it, you write more than one novel at the same time. How is the next long one coming?
I do. I have been working on the long. I've interrupted the long one, three times now. So my last book, I Am Sovereign, interrupted it. And I've written a little mini novel, and I'm I'm back now, and this one, and I'm back now working on the big one. I always say a long novel is like the flu, and a little novel is like a sneeze. So the little novels are more pleasurable. The long novels are a bit of a slog for me. But yes, I am diligently working away on it.
It's been lovely to talk to you tonight, Nicola Barker. Thank you so much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.
My thanks to Nicola Barker. Her latest novel, Tony Interrupter, is published by Granta Books. Tomorrow night on the programme, Neil Jordan is going to be talking to me and about his films adapted from other works ahead of the Adaptation Film Festival. We're going to find out a little bit more about the upcoming production of Three Sisters at this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. And we have author Dave Tynan on the programme tomorrow night on his debut collection of short stories, We Used to Dance Here. That's it for tonight's Arena, produced by Reg Luby. The research tonight was by Liam Murphy. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Niall McMonagle was on sound. I'm Rick O'Shea. Talk to you tomorrow evening here on Radio 1 from 6:30, and John Creedon is next.